morning, Brother Sid Strickland from Orlando will be giving us our two exhortations, our exposition. And his title is Russia, From Byzantium to the Third Rome, or the Making of the King of the North. And this theme is going to be continued tomorrow by Brother Mack. To start, for a Bible reading, we'd like to turn to Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8, we're going to start at verse 20 and read through the end of the chapter, which is verse 27. Daniel chapter 8, verse 20. The ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policies also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand. He shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Wherefore shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. And I, Daniel, fainted, and was sick certain days. Afterwards I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. With that, we'd like to call on Brother Sid.
Good morning, everyone. Certainly a pleasure for us to be here with you to enjoy the fellowship of this week as well as the study. Our topic this morning is Russia from Byzantium to the Third Rome, the making of the King of the North. And before we go there, I'd like to talk just for a moment about a couple of things that Brother Tommy highlighted yesterday, and he well emphasize this, but this is a see what's going on here. We're on the screen, but we're not up here. There we go. This is a chart from the work The Grand Structure of the Apocalypse by Bartholomew. And you'll notice that it is indeed the historical plan of the apocalypse. Now, Brother Tommy pointed out yesterday that indeed the correct interpretation of the apocalypse is the continuous historical one. And there are a variety of others that are out there. But of course, John was given the revelation in AD 96 on the Isle of Patmos by Christ. And we see the unfolding of history throughout the ages, leading from AD 96 right up through the establishment of the kingdom. And this isn't coincidental by any means, because the Lord has used history to execute his plan. Here are five reasons, and I'll run through this pretty quickly, for the continuous historical interpretation of the apocalypse. First of all, God promised a prophetic record. And this interpretation gives to the book a rational and comprehensive structure or framework. The phrase, things which must shortly come to pass, is appropriate to this interpretation. Through the centuries, students have correctly identified their position on the basis of a continuous historical interpretation of events in the Roman world. The ultimate test, the fit of history to the symbols. These are only five reasons for the continuous historical. There are many others. This is a statement by Graham Pierce, and it was taken from the Revelation, Which Interpretation? Brother Thomas interprets the Revelation as a forecast of history from the time of John to the full establishment of the kingdom under Christ. He gives the book a clear and understandable structure. As the centuries pass, the activities that make up history are seen to be groups of divine judgments in various parts of Europe and the Middle East. The Lamb undoes the seven seals on the scroll, revealing six seal judgments, followed by the seventh seal, within which are found seven trumpet judgments. And we'll talk about two of those trumpets, the first two woe trumpets, today, Lord willing. The seventh trumpet is subdivided into seven final vials of the wrath of God to be poured out. Additionally, the conflict between God's people, called the Holy City and the two witnesses, and the apostasy, is described as a ravaging of wild beasts. The coming of Christ is a lamb on Mount Zion who is declared to be the Lion of the tribe of Judah. The way in which the symbols shown to John describe what subsequently becomes history is fascinating. The fit between the symbols and history, the fit between the symbols and history provides assurance that this is the correct interpretation. Not only does the correspondence between the symbols and the onflowing history justify the exposition, but it will be found that this interpretation has no gaps. It is able to interpret all the very extensive detail of the book. This cannot be said of the other interpretations. In quoting from the exposition of Daniel in the preface, the Apocalypse throws great light upon the book of Daniel, the hidden mystery of which it expounds. The eternal spirit, styled by Peter the Spirit of Christ, is the real author of both prophecies. And what he omitted to tell Daniel, he communicated about 700 years after to the Apostle John. And all for the benefit of those who walk by faith and are the called according to his purpose. Should it be necessary, then, to exhort such to make both the Apocalypse and the book of Daniel the subject of diligent and persistent meditation, that they may be able to take heed to the sure word of prophecy, which was the focus of Brother Scott's remarks last evening, the sure word of prophecy, which is in very deed a light shining in a dark place. No genuine believer of the gospel of the kingdom will need such an exhortation. It is the honor of the kings and priests of the deity to search out what he has condescended to reveal. In ages past, and this is from Malthus Israel, in ages past God has had among the nations a people of his own. These are wise in the wisdom of God and venerate his word above all things. Though not his counselors, he has graciously condescended to inform them what he intends to do before it comes to pass. Hence it is testified by the prophet that the Lord will surely do nothing, but he revealeth his secret unto his servants, the prophets. This revelation is made that his people's faith may be confirmed and enlarged, and that in every generation they may know the times and seasons to which they stand related. Knowing the signs, they are enabled to discern the times, and while consternation and dismay cause men's hearts to fail, they are courageous and rejoice in perceiving the approach of the kingdom of God. This is the proper use of the prophetic word. It was thus that the ancients used it and were enabled to live in advance of their contemporaries. From these premises, we may conclude that as the Lord has also revealed what is to come to pass in these latter days, it is both our duty and privilege to make ourselves acquainted with it, that our faith may grow and be strengthened. Our affections be attached from the fleeting present and set more firmly on things to come, that our minds may be fortified against error, and that we may be prepared to meet the Lord as those who have kept their garments and shall not be put to shame. So I wanted to just highlight some of the things that Brother Tommy had emphasized yesterday. Indeed, we know that the Apocalypse is greatly aligned with the book of Daniel. As we said, our topic is the making of the King of the North. And the King of the North's development and ultimate destruction at the hands of Christ and the redeemed, while frequently directly related in the Scriptures, is also reflected in parallels or types. These were literal events that illustrate as well the events of the latter days concerning the King of the North. For example, Abraham's battle with Chedorlaomer of Elam and his allied kings. Others include Joshua's certain campaigns and Joshua's conquest of the land of Canaan. The work of the judges, such as Deborah, Barak, and Jael's contention with the host of King Jabin and his commander Sisera. The achievements and conquests of King David. Esther and Mordecai's conflict with Haman, the Agagite, and we know that's a term that comes from Gog, and his ultimate destruction. In the Psalms, and turn to Psalm 91 with me if you would. Sometimes it's very subtle in how it appears, but once again, not coincidental. Look at verses 13. Let's start with verse 11, actually. For he shall give his angels charge over thee, to keep thee in all thy ways. They shall bear thee up in their hands, lest thou dash thy foot against a stone. And of course, this psalm is speaking of the refuge we have in the Lord. And note this next verse. Thou shalt tread upon the lion and adder, or the viper or serpent. The young lion and the dragon shalt thou trample under feet. So it mentions the serpent, and it's the serpent power that we will talk about over the course of these 4 days, as it is manifested collectively in the ecclesiastical aspect of Western Rome, and then the political and civil military facet in Eastern Rome. It mentions specifically the serpent, the lion, and the dragon. And of course, throughout the prophets, we have mention of the king of the north and what will transpire therewith. And that was clearly illustrated from Brother Tommy's consideration of the apocalypse and the prophets yesterday. We'll begin our consideration of the making of the king of the north by going back a bit in time and looking at Daniel 8. If you would turn there with me, please. Daniel, the 8th chapter. And let's read verse 3. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up first. Here Daniel 8:3 records that the prophet Daniel saw a ram with two horns and was told that it represented the dual power of the Medes and the Persians. An appropriate symbol, as the Persian kings wore a crown, actually, that was like a ram's head. Here we see a picture on a coin of Alexander, also very appropriate since he conquered Persia. Alexander the Great, and you'll notice that he has the crown of the ram. Horns, we are told, were high, denoting the widespread power of the Persians. Look at this slide of the Persian Empire, and you'll notice its scope. Ultimately, it eclipsed that of the Babylonian Empire, as we see here. Look at the contrast, Babylonian and the Persian. One horn, again, we are told, was higher than the other, coming up later, which signifies the fact that the Persians would ultimately dominate. This is a familiar slide to us here, of the he-goat and the ram. And if you'll look at the 4th verse of Daniel 8 with me, I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. Ram, or the Persians, pushed westward, conquering Babylon Mesopotamia, Syria, and Asia Minor. In the north, Colchis, Armenia, Iberia, and the regions around the Caspian Sea. In the south, Cyrus conquered Palestine, Egypt, and Ethiopia, as well as Libya. In Daniel 8:5, we read, "And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat from the west on the face of the whole earth touched and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between the eyes." A notable horn between the eyes. And specifically, this was Alexander the Great. The notable horn was extremely powerful, as we read from the scriptures. And in short measure, he conquered Syria, Phoenicia, Cyprus, Tyre, Gaza, Egypt, Babylonia, Persia, Media, Hyrcania, and then moved actually into India. And here we have a slide of Alexander's conquest. I'm not sure how well you can see that from the back. But you can see, again, the scope of his conquest. And it's quite interesting because Alexander was only in his 20s at this point in time. And yet his military prowess was truly unique. And we're told scripturally that it was not in and of himself, but indeed it was through the intervention of the deity. I'd like to quote from the book of the Maccabees concerning the conquest of Alexander. "He made many wars and won many strongholds and slew the kings of the earth. He went through to the ends of the earth and took the spoils of many nations, insomuch that the earth was quiet before him, and he ruled over countries and nations and kings who became tributary to him." Excuse me. A little extra wind up there. Thank you, David. I think that will help. We know that Alexander's life was cut off in its prime at age 32, when his triumphs were at their fullest, at the very height of his power. And we're told that he was strong, but ultimately that great horn was broken. Look at the 8th verse of Daniel, the 8th chapter. "Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable horns toward the four winds of heaven." And what we're doing here is setting the stage for the full development of the king of the north. Because here's where it all began. It was rumored that Alexander actually said on his deathbed that his kingdom should go to the strongest. And indeed, it ultimately did. The kingdom was divided between his four generals, represented by the four horns that came up in the place of the broken horn. You can see that illustration down here, the broken horn and the four horns that came up. Two of these horns were of specific import because their territorial disputes encompassed the Holy Land. General Seleucus reigned in the north, and General Ptolemy with Israel in the middle. So we can see how oftentimes Israel experienced the pains that were inflicted by the invading armies. Here's a slide of the divisions. I'm not sure, again, how well you can see this. With the four generals, here we have up here Cassander. We have Lysimachus here. We have Ptolemy, and this, of course, and Antigonus here. And then, of course, Seleucus in this area. So this is the Seleucid kingdom. This is the Ptolemaic, which we see will become quite significant as we progress. All right, let's look at the 9th verse of Daniel 8. "And out of one of them, out of one of these four horns came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great, toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land. Here we see the Seleucid kingdom, the Ptolemaic. Ultimately, they allied and conquered Antigonus, who was the last remaining of the others, and ultimately reigned in power independently, the two of them. The little horn of the goat, depicting the military power of Rome, became quite powerful. And as the Iron Kingdom in Nebuchadnezzar's image, it broke the other powers into pieces and subdued them, as we read in Daniel 2:40. The Jewish people were suppressed by the iron might of Rome. The pagan power of Rome persecuted the Christian religion, both true and false, in addition to the Jewish people. The little horn of the goat in the prophecy of Daniel is depicted in Revelation 12:3 as a great red dragon. Turn with me to Revelation 12, if you will. And I'd like to pick up at verse 13. And when the dragon saw that he was cast into the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, and this associates it with the Romans, that she might fly into the wilderness into her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time, or 1260 years, from the face of the serpent. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. And the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus. And in this section, of course, we again are introduced to the dragon, and it is this same dragon power that we'll see manifested in the last days, although Christianized. And I'd like to read just a little excerpt from the Apocalypse epitomized. A paganized Christianity had supplanted the original paganism, so that now the symbols of serpent and dragon relate to the so-called Christianized empire. Finally, when Constantine transferred his civil and military headquarters from Rome to Constantinople, previously the very center of pagan resistance, the dragon became identified with the civil and military power of a so-called Christianized empire. It was from the face of this pseudo-Christian serpent dragon that the woman, the original Protestants, fled. Before Constantine came to power, the dragon was pagan in character, but afterwards it was changed to a pseudo-Christian or Catholic power. And though Constantine fought for personal power and prestige, he camouflaged his ambitions by claiming that he strove for religious liberty. The character, therefore, depicts the dragon in two aspects, as pagan and as pseudo-Christian. The woman likewise is shown both in power and in persecution. Daniel therefore deals with two horns. One is the Holy Roman power of the West that arose after the ten horns, and the second, the pagan Roman power in the East, appearing in Syria and Palestine in the latter days of the Macedonian kings and many centuries before the ten horns. Brother Thomas has this to say in Elpis Israel. The little horns are representative of powers on certain territories, not races, not of races. And this is very important because it's a territorial issue. The little horns are representative of powers on certain territories, not of races. It matters not whether they be pagan Romans, Catholic Greeks, Muslim Turks, or Greek Catholic Russians. The power that rules in Constantinople and plants its standard in Assyria is the little horn of the Assyro-Macedonian horn of the goat, And we know, of course, that this will be true of Russia in the not-too-distant future. Russia will become the horn of the goat and begins its careers by crucifying the prince of the host, destroying Jerusalem and the temple, sets up a god in Rome whom his fathers knew not, and ends by standing up against Michael, the prince of princes, our Lord Jesus Christ, who brings him to his end with none to help him. All the power of the dragon in relation to Israel in the land of promise is embodied in the little horn of the east. The smiting of the image, the breaking of the goat's little horn, and the binding of the dragon are synchronous and synonymous catastrophes. And the stone, the prince of princes, the Messiah the prince, and Michael the great prince who stands up for Israel are but different titles by which the Lord Jesus is designated, who is to descend from heaven and fight the battle of God Almighty against them. Daniel 8 reveals and clarifies a new entity, a specific power, a little horn coming up from one of the four horns. And I think this slide illustrates that pretty well. History confirms that it was from the northern Seleucid horn. This new power was that of Rome, and while originally invited to support the Greeks, they became the victors over Greece. The Roman power thus succeeded the Greek Babylonian power, ultimately killing the prince of the host and destroying the temple and the nation. In Daniel 8, let's go back to Daniel 8, please. And let's read verses 23 through 25. In the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. Of course, this is Rome. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. Prophet Daniel was made keenly aware of the fact that this power would exist at the time of the end. Little horn of the goat, again depicting the military power of Rome, became quite powerful. As the Iron Kingdom in Nebuchadnezzar's image, as we said, it broke the other powers into pieces and subdued them. Daniel, therefore, deals clearly with these two horns, the little horn of the goat and the ecclesiastical power in the West. Daniel 8:14, and let's go back to the 14th verse of Daniel. Daniel 8:14 speaks of a period of adversity for the Jewish nation, extending for 2,300 years. And this figure of 2,300, Brother Thomas believed to be 2,400, citing a Septuagint translation of his day. I believe it's actually 2,300. It's logical that this time frame would begin with the vision of this chapter, which is the appearance of the goat on the scene when it came close unto the ram and was moved with choler against him, as we read in verse 7 of Daniel 8. Alexander was victorious. A multitude of battles characterized his efforts, and he was victorious in them all. But two were particularly of consequence. See if I can move this forward here. You'll notice the Battle of Granicus. I'm not sure you can read that. And then the Battle of Issus. The Battle of Granicus took place in B.C. 334, and the Battle of Issus in B.C. 333. Persia, at the time of the Battle of Issus, was fully and finally conquered with this conflict. In 2300 years, if we look at 2300 years from B.C. 333-334, it brings us to 1967. And we know that this was an unusual victory in the history of Israel. It was the Six Days' War. Jerusalem was liberated and ultimately controlled by the Israelis. This was the beginning of the cleansing or avenging of the sanctuary maintained in Daniel 8:14, or mentioned in Daniel 8:14. We say the beginning of the avenging of the sanctuary because it wasn't fully accomplished, of course, in 1967. Here's a quote from the exposition of Daniel by Brother Thomas. Let it be also observed that this does not teach that the avenging of the holy is to commence immediately. The last of the 2400, 2300, we believe, evening morning is finished. It only gives us to understand that when that period is past, the next series of events in relation to the Holy Land shall be the manifestation of things necessary. So we're looking at 67 up through today. Necessary to wrest from the Gentiles and to avenge it in their overthrow. Daniel, in this eighth chapter, again, makes it very clear that there is the power in the west and the power in the east. In AD 324, Constantine transferred the political and military administration to Constantinople. And we know today Constantinople is Istanbul in Turkey. With this move, Constantinople became the headquarters of the Little Horn of the Goat. And Rome continued as the headquarters of the Little Horn of the Fourth Beast, which of course is the focus of Daniel 7. In time, the empire became completely divided into east and west, Constantinople and Rome being their respective capitals. In Daniel 11, we continue the consideration of the Roman Little Horn. And there's further explanation concerning this eastern power. It's again prophesied that the little horn of the goat and the little horn of the fourth beast, Daniel 7:8, while speaking of Rome collectively, and that's important for us to recognize, while speaking of Rome collectively, one power is ecclesiastical Rome, which is the papal power, and depicted here in Nebuchadnezzar's image in the eastern leg. Or the western leg, excuse me, and the eastern leg being representative of the political power, the military power of Rome. Its activity was of the power in the west was focused primarily on Western Europe, with the Jews and dissenters being its targets. The eastern leg, on the other hand, of the image corresponds with the little horn of the goat and denotes the civil, once again, and military power of Rome. The activities of the eastern leg focus primarily on the Holy Land and the nation of Israel. In time, Constantine, as we said in 324, transferred this civil and military power and administration to Constantinople. And this contributed to Rome's prosperity in the east. The Byzantine Empire, which integrated the Greek culture, very appropriate inasmuch as the Roman Empire had obtained its power, actually, from the Greek Empire. And we'll talk a little bit more here in a moment about the Byzantine Empire, because it wasn't called the Byzantine Empire at this point in time. We think of it as only the eastern portion of the Roman Empire. Constantinople fell in 1453 to the Turks, and the Roman power as symbolized by the double-headed eagle. And you see this here. The double-headed eagle looking east and west, signified the Eastern Roman Empire and the Western Roman Empire in the two heads. And you'll notice that this is the coat of arms of the Russian Empire. The two-headed eagle, same designation. Once again, not coincidence. Time, we know that Constantine allowed this portion of the empire to take on quite a significance in the overall scheme of things. And as we said, and Brother Tommy pointed this out yesterday, it lasted for a period of 1,129 years. And Constantinople, for the most part, was fairly impenetrable because of its fortifications, the wall. And ultimately, of course, it took some unusual firepower to conquer it. We know that this concept of the two-headed eagle, as we said, also relates to Russia. And we see we'll ultimately see the Eastern power manifested in Russia, as Russia asserts herself in the Holy Land, and is a part of the Gogian host, which I know we'll get into in the next couple of exhortations. And we know that all of this came about during the time of the Tsars. We see the establishment of what, in essence, was the Third Rome, and we'll talk more about that here in just a minute. The little horn of the fourth beast was prospering in the West. The Holy Roman Empire was supported by Charlemagne, and Brother Tommy talked about this yesterday. And he actually came to power in 799. He was crowned on Christmas Day in 799. Typically, we think of that establishment of the Holy Roman Empire in 800 AD. You'll see how the dragon symbol carried through from Egypt, Babylon, Rome, and Russia as well. Here we see the beast of the sea, the beast of the earth, the image of the beast, the dragon power, which again was spoken of yesterday. This is the two-horned beast phase. Charlemagne giving the papacy its strength. Two horns representing the ecclesiastical as well as the military or political aspect. I'd like to digress for just a moment and talk a little bit about the Byzantine Empire. It actually takes its name from a small fishing town known as Byzantium, whose name was later Latinized to Byzantium. Its most important geographical asset was its location as a very easily defensible peninsula and a large harbor known as the Golden Horn. Let me jump ahead and we'll come back to the other slides. Here you'll see the Golden Horn right here in this area. This would have been the area of Constantinople, which is today Istanbul. The town sat on the edge of the Strait of the Bosphorus, which led from the Black Sea to the Sea of Marmara and thence to the Mediterranean. By controlling the strait, it was in a position to control shipping between the east and the west. Literally, it was the crossroads of the European and Asian trade routes. The Roman Emperor Constantine chose Byzantium for the new capital of the empire because it was located in the wealthier and more productive part of the empire, and because it allowed him to maintain a very close watch on the Sassanid Empire of Persia and the German tribes on the lower Danube River. It became the military and political center of the empire, as we pointed out, and the dominant economic center of the eastern Mediterranean. And this was up until 1453, when indeed it fell to the Turks. The collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Eastern or Byzantine Empire, continued with roads, lines of authority, and legal institutions inherited from their Roman predecessors. One important distinction was the language of Byzantium was Greek rather than Roman. Constantine built the city on lavish standards with libraries, museums, and so forth. And there were marble palaces and baths and churches. And his effort, of course, was to create, and indeed he did so, a second Rome. Byzantine Empire is the term conventionally used to describe the Greek-speaking Roman Empire during the Middle Ages, centered at its capital in Constantinople. In certain specific contexts, usually referring to the time before the fall of the Western Roman Empire, it is also often referred to as the Eastern Roman Empire. And there is not consensus among the historians as to when the Byzantine Empire actually started, and it wasn't called the Byzantine until the 15th century. But we know, of course, that in essence it was took on its real significance at the time that Constantine established it as the power in the East. So the term Byzantine was actually not coined until 1557. And the standardization of the term Byzantine didn't occur until the 18th century. Constantinople was initially not considered worth the effort of conquest, but with the advent of cannons, the walls, which had been impenetrable except by the Fourth Crusade over 1,000 years, no longer offered adequate protection from the Ottomans. And the fall of Constantinople finally came after a two-month siege by Mohammed II. And you can see the Ottoman Empire here in 1453. And here's a picture of Mohammed II. Mohammed and his successors continued to consider themselves proper heirs to the Byzantines until their own demises early in the 20th century. And by the end of the century, the Ottoman Empire had established its firm rule over Asia Minor and most of the Balkan Peninsula. Meanwhile, the role of the emperor as patron of Eastern Orthodoxy was now claimed by the Grand Dukes of Muscovy, starting with Ivan III. His grandson, Ivan IV, would become the first Tsar of Russia. And their successors supported the idea that Moscow was the proper heir to Rome and Constantinople, a third Rome, if you will. Russia remained as the only free Orthodox state after the Turkish takeover of Byzantium. The Grand Prince, Ivan III, had married the niece of a Byzantine emperor, and this was seen as making the Romanov royal line a continuation of Byzantine royalty. Further, the Russian Church had gained autonomy in 1448, when the capital of the Roman Empire moved from Rome to Constantinople. Constantinople became known in the East as New Rome, or the Second Rome. And with the fall of Constantinople, many began to feel that Moscow had taken Constantinople's place, becoming, in effect, the Third Rome. Grand Prince Ivan IV, or Ivan the Terrible, declared himself to be Tsar, equivalent to an emperor, in 1547. The concept of a second Rome applied to Constantinople as a city, though arguable the whole Eastern Roman Empire as well, the Third Rome has always referred to Russia as a whole. When the monk Philotheus Piskov spoke of the Third Rome, he referred to the Russian Empire as a whole, saying, "The two Romes have fallen. Two Romes have fallen. But the third stands, and the fourth there will not be." And indeed, with Russian citizens constituting about half of Orthodox Christians today, the Russian Empire has proved to be the Third Rome. Let me go back for just a moment here. I want to talk about, and this was prior to the conquest of Constantinople in 1453. We see the trumpet periods, and you'll notice here with the fifth and sixth trumpets, we have the introduction of the Arabs. And I'd like to spend just a few minutes talking about some of that and how it relates to our topic of the development of the King of the North. This is a chart by Brother Thomas, and you'll notice that he's highlighted two areas, the fifth trumpet, or first woe trumpet, and the loosing of the four angels. And these relate to the Eastern Roman Empire, and we'll see how it relates here in just a moment. If we go to the ninth chapter of Revelation, and verse 1, "And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power as to the scorpions of the earth, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. And to them it was given that they should not kill them, but they should be tormented 5 months in their torment as the torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man. And in those days shall men seek death, and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. And the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle, and on their heads were, as it were, crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men. And they had hair as the hair of women, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions. And they had breastplates, as it were, breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots of many horses running to battle. And they had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon." And in verse 12, "One woe is past," and this is the first woe trumpet, "and behold, there come two woes more hereafter." And of course, this is speaking of the period, as you see here, from 632 to 932, and the loosing of the four Turk angels, which of course would have been the Seljuks, the Mongols, the Tartars, and also the Ottomans, in 1062 to 1453 in the fall of Constantinople. You see those a little better here. And this is a quote actually from the book Unsealed, and referring to this chart that we saw just prior. "The two other green patches on a line with the one I have just noticed, but farther to the right of the chart, represent the complications developed by the fifth trumpet in the organization of the Mohammedan power and the letting loose of the Saracens in the year 632. When the Battle of Muta commenced their invasion of the Byzantine Empire. They were to prevail 5 months of years, at the end of which, having reached the turning point, they were to commence to decline and continue declining for another 5 months of years, when they were to come to an end. This came to pass. The Saracens were submerged in the Turkish power in 932, exactly 10 months and years, or 300 years from their invasion of the Greek Empire. The period comprehends all that you read in history about the Crusades in the Middle Ages." The second square, farther to the right, represents the period during which the four angels were loosed from the river Euphrates. That is, the four Mohammedan-Euphratian powers were developed, resulting in the formation of the Turkish power. As we said, this was the Seljuks, this would have been the Mongols, the Tartars, and lastly, the Ottomans, the four angels of the sixth trumpet. Resulting in the formation of the Turkish power, which overthrew Constantinople, as we said, in 1453. They were prepared for an hour, a day, a month, and a year, or 391 years. 30 days, which was exactly the time that elapsed between the crossing of the Euphrates by Arslan the Valiant in 1062 and the fall of Constantinople in 1453. And you'll see that if we add that time frame to 1062, it brings us exactly to 1453. The Turks have held Constantinople from that day to this. I have a, let me grab a book that I left back here. A bit of the history from this period as well. This is from Hear What the Spirit Saith to the Ecclesias by John Knowles. Writing of this fifth trumpet period, he says, under the unifying banner of the prophet, the sinewy Arab warriors burst out of their hot, dry homeland in the abyss, as it's scripturally referred to. Behind them lay a peninsula one-third buried in sand dunes. Ahead was an irresistible lure. Booty for those who live, paradise for those who died fighting the unbeliever. One Arab historian says, the believers smote and slaughtered till the going down of the sun, and the fear of the Arabs fell upon all kings. The Catholic either renounced his religion and became Mohammedan or fell victim to the torments of the locusts. If you'll go back to Revelation with me, and let's pick up actually at verse 13, because I'd like to read this section concerning the sixth trumpet. So we can see how the Turks came to power and have continued that power up through the present day. Even though we have seen the gradual drying up of the Euphratian or the Turkish power, it's not dried up completely, but shortly it will be. Picking up at verse 13. And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year, for to slay the third part of men. And the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000,000, and I heard the number of them. And, of course, this isn't an actual number, but just to show the magnitude or scope of all of these four angels. Thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them having breastplates of fire and hyacinth and brimstone, and the heads of the horses were as the heads of lions, and out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone. Here again, you know, a picture of the Ottomans. By these three was the third part of the men killed, by the fire and by the smoke and by the brimstone which issued out of their mouths. And here in this context, we have a very vivid picture of gunfire and what transpired as a result of their firepower and what they were able to do, enabling them, of course, to ultimately conquer Constantinople, which prior to this time frame had been impossible. It says, by these three was the third part of men killed, by the fire, by the smoke, by the brimstone, which issued out of their mouths. For their power is in their mouth and in their tails. For their tails were like unto serpents and had heads, and with them they do hurt. And this is speaking of their guns and again, their firepower. And the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone, and of wood, which neither can see, nor hear, nor walk. Neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their thefts. Reading just a bit about the history of the sixth trumpet. A new power had built up in northwestern Anatolia, ready to break into Europe. This was the Ottoman power. Although initially subjects of the Seljuk Empire, the Ottoman Turks had won their independence as the Seljuk Empire disintegrated under the impact of the Mongol invasions. In 1301, they gained their first victory over the Byzantines. In 1356, they crossed the Dardanelles and invaded Europe. And in 1397, with Constantinople almost all that was left to the Byzantines, the Ottomans surrounded the city and demanded its surrender. However, the city was saved by the advance of the Mongols under Tamerlane, who met and defeated the Ottoman forces in Ankara in July of 1402. So they were thwarted at that point. In 1422, the Turks were again at the walls of Constantinople, and this time the city was only saved by revolt in Anatolia, which drew away the Turkish forces. In 1453, however, under Muhammad II, Constantinople was captured after a siege which lasted 40 days. Firearms, both muskets and cannons, were used in this battle, and from that day, when it fell into the hands of the Ottoman Empire, Constantinople remained the Turkish capital. And we know, of course, that this has to change in these latter days, and soon it will change, because we all believe very strongly, of course, that Russia will necessarily invade Turkey and establish itself in Constantinople, at which time it will become the little horn of the goat. We said the king of the north was in the past one of the four Greek horns that ruled the area that we know as Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and actually a part of Turkey. And it will be manifest in these later days, these latter days. And we'll talk more about that as we get into the latter part of Daniel 11. The goat little horn power is also existent at the time of the end. And why both of these symbols? Relative to this, there's an excerpt in Milestones concerning these events. The visions of Daniel chapters 8, 11, and 12 were given to convey details that were not apparent in the details of Nebuchadnezzar's image and the four beasts. I apologize, I'm trying to go a little too quickly. It showed the relationship of the Roman Empire to the Greek northern horn and the happenings that affected the Jews in the Holy Land. And note that I want to emphasize that it showed the relationship of the Roman Empire to the Greek northern horn and the happenings that affected the Jews in the Holy Land. Historically, the king of the north never held the area of Constantinople. Very important fact. Historically, the king of the north never held the area of Constantinople, whereas it was the center of the little horn of the goat power. Russia is the king of the north in the latter days. And when it takes Constantinople, it also becomes the little horn of the goat. When it takes Constantinople, it will become the little horn of the goat. At the time of the end, we have to think of these symbols as representations of powers. And this goes back to what Brother Thomas says in Elpis Israel. Representations of powers on certain territories, not races. It will be the power that occupies their territory that will be the fulfillment of these two symbols. We know that the little horn of the fourth beast also endures to the time of the end. And that is, of course, the papal system, which will also be destroyed by Christ. So hopefully we have a fairly clear picture. And I know I jumped around a lot, but I wanted to make sure we touched upon exactly how we got to this point with the two horn powers of Rome. And I think we'll stop here and pick up the next hour.